You know, I don't think humans ever have been alone. The data suggests that there have been interstellar visitors involved with this planet since earliest recorded human history. But, you know, what's interesting about this time is that we're at the point where we can emerge into a global and interplanetary civilization, or we can terminate, which many civilizations that have been on the planet before have. And so this is a big, this is the big choice, this half a million year choice we're in. So far, we've mucked it up pretty badly, frankly, certainly since World War II. So that's, you know, I think a lot of what impelled me to leave my medical career was realizing what the stakes were and the time that we are on in history. This is a really pivotal point in history between an old era that's dying and a new one that's trying to emerge. Man, if it's not guided out properly, it can be a very rocky business.
Absolutely. And a paradigm shift is certainly something that I've intuitively been feeling for a while, and I definitely don't seem to be the only one who is sensing that. And there's a lot of different sectors, including obviously the phenomenon and our increasing kind of interest and involvement in that particular facet. Just the world in general seems to be in a very destabilized state, which for me, although it looks like an extremely concerning state to be in, I kind of look at it through the lens of my own life. And I think about, you know, the times where things have collapsed for me, or you know, moments of sadness or chaos. And it always ends up becoming the actual necessary steps towards a better outcome.
Well, it's a global, what we call phase transition in physics, quantum physics. And in Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, that documentary came out a couple of years ago. Yeah, you know, we describe this phenomenon where as you get about 1% of the population aligning of coherence towards a big change, and this is in physics and superfluidity of helium, there at that 1% point, everything becomes very, very, very chaotic. And then suddenly, when it hits that 1% of helium molecules aligning, it becomes superfluid, they call it, very coherent, very peaceful, almost magical qualities. So I think on a macro social scale, that's sort of what human civilization is going through. Now, the risk is, you know, during that chaos, because humans have free will, we're not just a mechanical quantum physics system, and we have weapons that are very destructive, and the means to destroy the planet environmentally, there are a convergence of risk factors that have come together that are being very badly managed, or not managed at all, because the people who are in charge, that we think are in charge, are unaware of the problems or the solutions. This is why right now we're working on this documentary called The Lost Century. So if people go to thelostcenturyfilm.com, you'll see we're crowdfunding another documentary film should come out this spring, we hope, like Unacknowledged and Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. But this is really going to be focusing on the environment, the new energy technologies, the propulsion systems, and the 100 years plus, I say the lost century conservatively. In reality, it's more like 120, 30, 40 years of advancements in electromagnetic sciences and post-quantum and transdimensional physics, as it's called, that have been suppressed, covered up. For obvious reasons. I mean, you've always had economic cartels on the planet, whether it was this empire or that empire. But now we're talking about a global interest in keeping the status quo of oil and gas and coal and nuclear power, and for that matter, solar and wind, which I think is a diversion away from the actual solutions, because as someone who owns the largest legal solar farm in the state of Virginia, which has 10 million people, I can tell you it will not run our house. It's the largest legally allowable solar farm. Let me repeat that. Without going to a commercial permit, which costs millions of dollars. So basically, the solutions that are actually going to fix the problem is on NOAA's radar. So what we're trying to do with the Lost Century film is to prove that, in fact, those solutions exist, have existed, but there are very corrupt interests that do not want them out, because it's, you know, we're talking $1 quadrillion, you know, $1,000 trillion or more in assets that are going to be replaced with things that would sit on your coffee table and run your house with no energy supply, because it's pulling energy from the quantum vacuum flux field or zero point energy field or whatever the name of the day is. But and I think actually many of these physicists are describing different aspects of the same energy field, to be honest with you. Some have called it the dark energy or the black energy field of the cosmos. I think in reality, when it all gets more quantified, we're going to find that they're describing various parts of the same elephant, but they're all holding different parts of it. But the fact of the matter is, from an empirical scientific point of view, people like Nikola Tesla,
mm-hmm.
not the fake Tesla, not the fake cars. I call that a Musk. That's an Elon Musk car. He doesn't have a Tesla. A Tesla, we would never have to plug in. Listen, it would have an electromagnetic generator in it and motor, a little battery, not 900 pounds of lithium ion poisonous batteries that explode and catch fire. A little battery. It would stay charged. The thing would run. You'd never have to recharge it. And I'm actually talking to a group of people who potentially have a technology that could do it. But most of them are already have made strategic decisions that are going to guarantee their failure. This is a discussion we can get into. Why do we keep making the same mistakes?
Please.
Why do people...
If you want to get into that now, let's get into it.
Well, it's human hubris. And the old saying, pride goeth before a fall. So what happens is people who are, let's say they're a genius in physics and electromagnetic engineering, or they've stumbled across a phenomenon. The problem is they also think that they're a genius strategically and in terms of what you're up against. Because most people think, oh, Jesus, I built a better mousetrap. Now the world's going to beat a path to my door. And the truth is, Murder Incorporated is going to beat a path to your door. You step on the wrong landmine, you're dead. And the best case scenario is that your technology gets bought out and put on a black shelf. You know, BP recently bought about 10 years ago a battery that would have been a revolutionary battery and put it on a shelf. I know for a fact, I know the guy who was brokering the deal, Elon Musk wanted to acquire that technology. Poof, they outbid him by so many billions of dollars at that time. And it's on a shelf. Now, this has happened thousands and thousands of times. Not a conspiracy theory. It's how cartels work. It's how people acting in their own interests operate. So if you're running an organization, you don't want to see the price of a barrel of oil go from $100 a barrel or 80 down to $4 or $5 a barrel, which is all it'd be worth if all we needed for is plastics and synthetics. We don't need it for energy, right? So you're talking about an entire collapse of trillions of dollars, not only in infrastructure, public utilities, trillions, hundreds of trillions. Don't need them. Surface roads. Mm-hmm. We have anti-gravity developed 50s. Those were perfected in 1954. So, but the people who invent these systems, they're looking at it only from, they have these blinders on where they say, I've got something that's great. All I need to do is raise enough money and I can get it out to the public. No. You're not, because you don't understand your adversary. You don't understand who's going to be in there. Every step of the way, they're going to know what you're doing in real time. Encryption isn't going to help you. None of these sort of things that people think are tactical security are going to help you. I mean, this is one of the things I'm mentoring the U.S. government on right now, the part of the government trying to get into the UAP UFO issue. It's that the group that you're concerned about, these clandestine deep black operations, they have technologies that are reverse engineered from interstellar craft that are thousands of years ahead of you. So you're not going to be able to keep anything secret from that organization. Mm. And it is a corrupt organization. So you have to look at it as what it is. It's basically the world's largest criminal syndicate, but it involves, you know, hundreds of trillions of dollars. In the U.S. alone, we estimate $8.5 to $10 trillion have gone into those projects, unsupervised by the Congress or the president. Now, that doesn't count your country.
Right, of course, because, you know, the UK is as part of the Five Eyes and, you know, a longstanding partner of the US. I would imagine that we're very much involved. I mean, we've got, you know, some cases that are well known, like Rendlesham, for example, and it's pretty clear that we're being very quiet. I mean, the Ministry of Defense hasn't given any sort of statements about some of the progression that we've seen in terms of congressional and legislative action on this subject. So we're being very quiet. I think we're sitting back and watching the Americans and making a decision about whether we're going to dip our toe into the water publicly on this subject. But I think what you spoke to there, and it's something obviously I know you've highlighted pretty much from the get-go, is that this is likely, if not definitely, beyond the reservation of standard government oversight and congressional oversight, and it's not necessarily an aspect of the government in the way that people would think, even in the special access program domain. This is maybe completely beyond the restrictions and oversight and special access programs. Yes. So how could this is the thing, Stephen, we've got the legislation coming in for the whistleblowers, you know, the NDAA has been signed into law, and they've got the Whistleblower Protection Act testimony kind of stuff coming out to, you know, keep these people safe if they want to come out and speak on the record. But how are they going to find these things if they're so deep down into the labyrinth?
That's my job.
Ah.
Let me be quite clear. That is what I do. So that bill, which I've been involved with, the identification and the transfer of whistleblowers from the assets I have to those people, not the people at AARO, the AARO. I'm talking the people who are actually behind and who manage the black budget that are being denied access to these projects. That's what we're doing.
Are those people on the side?
So I'm the underground railroad.
Mm-hmm. Are these people that you're speaking with, are they you know, involved in the kind of ODNI and AARO side of this, or is this a separate kind of alliance within the government?
Sure. I mean, they're part of all that, but they're above. They're the ones who would be your key people who would, say, be overseeing the black budget of the United States,
right,
the foreign letter agencies. Now, everyone's saying that this is the big problem. The public, I don't know who your demographic is.
Some of them are quite well-informed.
All right, so just imagine this. And, of course, people think that this cannot be true. A young doctor, myself, in his 30s, is invited to come up to Washington and brief the sitting director of the CIA, the Clinton administration, and then subsequently other people in the Congress and Intelligence Committee members. Whatever. This is all in the 90s. This is ancient history.
Mm-hmm.
And to my horror, I find out that those people were not read in. Read in is term for being briefed on something. And at that time, in my early days, I actually thought that if these folks could find out about the subject, they could make an inquiry, and because they're the top of the food chain constitutionally, legally, the president and his cabinet senior members who are have constitutional authority over the intelligence community or the Defense Department or what have you, would be told. No, they were lied to, told the bug off. And, you know, this goes on for years. You know about my briefing of Admiral Tom Wilson, who was head of intelligence, joint staff. After he retired, I disclosed to the public that this had happened. Everyone thought I had to be making it up. And then, of course, Dr. Davis's memo leaked after Edgar Mitchell passed away, because it was in Edgar Mitchell's archives, and I had invited Edgar Mitchell to the meeting as my guest so he could learn about the subject. He didn't know much about it, but Ed wanted to, astronaut Mitchell wanted to know, you know, what was going on, and he's a very, very smart guy, MIT and PhD and all this. Sixth man to walk on the moon. My uncle, who helped design the lunar module, helped carry him there, right? So I go, no. So you were there. And then just like all the other senior people in the U.S. government and in your country that I brief, including your Ministry of Defense head, years ago, Admiral Lord Hill Norton, that I spent quite a bit of time with, all these people that everyone, if you just met on the street, you said they would know everything that is classified black, deep black, anything. Because God is in his heaven and all is right with the world. Well, that's what I thought in my naivete in the early 90s. By 93, I was disabused of that fantasy and delusion. And then it's down the rabbit hole since then. So the reality is, people need to understand, is that there are two governments. There's an unconstitutional, unsanctioned, global superstate that runs these projects. It's not just U.S. or U.K. And it does not respond to constitutional authority, period. Secondly, the people who are in those positions in the US, UK, Five Eyes, other countries, if they know about this issue, it's because they were recruited earlier and moved up through the ranks. And they're still going to keep it secret from their colleagues at that level of government, whether it's a senator, a member of the House of Lords, a member of Parliament, a cabinet member, person in XYZ president's administration. Doesn't matter. Left, right, center, doesn't matter. So you have to understand the architecture of the secrecy. And then you have to understand what their assets are and what their agenda is. And if you don't understand this, so I get back to these inventors. If you're a bloke who's a brilliant engineer and a physicist working in a garage or a lab or wherever, Lawrence Livermore even, and you come across this phenomenon of how to create a very high voltage signal that taps this 0-point energy field, and you get way more power out than in, which is what overunity means. You're more out than in. It's not violating the laws of thermodynamics, because what's not being calculated is that almost infinite energy field, quote unquote, Nikola Tesla's words, not mine, that you're tapping into. So there's no conflict with the laws of physics if you understand physics, but you have to understand the part of the calculation that's being left out of the equations, which Maxwell, you know, the Maxwell equations were changed to leave that out, by the way, in the late 1800s. So this goes back 120, 30, 40 years, where this has all been trying to be kept silent. Now, maybe in that era, it was the Gilded Age of Rockefellers and what have you. Now, it's their predecessors and the people who are in the, let's call it the catbird seat of the global macroeconomic system. So you have to really understand this is about global power and technology and science and finance. It's not about ETs. It's not about that. But the problem is, and one of the things that, if you saw my presentation, that's kind of the backbone of this new documentary, which, by the way, we need people to help contribute to it. Everything we do is without a corporate sponsor. It's independent. Is it thelostcenturyfilm.com? In my presentation in California 2 months ago, in October, end of October, I basically said, look, these technologies have been around for over 100 years, and the reason they're not out is because there are very powerful forces that do not want it out. And if you're someone, if you have $100 million, which is a very small startup in Silicon Valley, and a technology like this, you will not get it out. If you had $100 billion, you're not going to. If you don't understand who you're up against and what you've got to do to get around that blockade. Now, the answer to it is actually radical and simple. You don't try to patent and keep it secret. You disclose it, open source it like GitHub, the software company, immediately upon confirmation that you have something. Now, no one wants to do that because we're all thinking, oh, I got to keep it secret because I want to be the next Rockefeller of energy and make $1 trillion. I want to be the next Elon Musk. Big mistake, because you can't, to get from where you are, even if you had $1 billion in a unicorn startup out of Silicon Valley, to where the world needs to get in the next 15, 20 years, or we're cooked, that strategy isn't going to work. So you have to rethink the entire strategic nexus, the entire strategic environment, and adjust your plans accordingly. Now, this is a very complex analysis. I'm not going to go into all of it. But if you don't do, though, if you don't account for that, I predict at the beginning that it's going to fail. I've been involved in every new energy startup for 30 years at one level or another, and have advised them. Stan Meyer, who had a water car, all these people, they all made the same predictable mistakes. They all kept their secret sauce secret. They took it to the grave. They were either killed or they died, or it was confiscated through a national security order, or it was bought by a big conglomerate and put on a black shelf. You know, now this is 100 and some years of doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. As Einstein said, that's the definition of insanity. So we need to stop being insane. But the problem is not that they're venal or stupid. It's that they don't know. So what we have to do, what I want to do with the Lost Century film is to prove that these technologies have existed, but also explain why they have vanished and what, going forward, we need to do as a people together to change that. So that means that if you have a technology like this, so, my group could come in and be sure that, you know, anywhere from 500 million to 2 billion people will know about it within a month. How do we do that? Well, the media is going to blacklist this. They're not going to cover this. CBS, BBC, New York Times, Washington Post, Sunday Times, no way it's going to be covered. So you get Tom Cruise drive a car running on it. You get Demi Lovato's house running on it. You get Ariana Grande to have her home or her motorboat running on it. I'm not kidding. People say, what? I say, yes. So the people who follow and support what we're doing, okay, here's what we have. Now you need to put this out there to your followers. And they have 100 million, 200 million. Boom. You've just bypassed the blockade in the mainstream media. You've just blockaded the CIA. You have just... They would have to uncouple the internet. So I there is a strategy and we have the means to do it. The problem is the people who have these technologies always think, oh, I can't let anyone know how it works because some other group will get ahead of me. To which I say, you should be so lucky because we need probably several hundred companies bigger than Amazon or Apple to transform 8 billion people living like cavemen, burning stuff for energy into a sustainable civilization in 20 years. And we barely have 20 years. I'd say it's more like 15. So if you're going to make that transition in the next generation, 20 years, you need to think that you're going to be the sole holder of that technology so that you can be some filthy rich tycoon is not only a sociopathic, frankly, view, but it's not realistic. It isn't going to happen. Now, if you disclose it the way I just described, to a billion, 2 billion people, open source it, where anyone who knows how to put a circuit together and build it can do it in their garage or their lab or their university. Tube that is squeezing a tube of toothpaste so hard, boom, it's out and you cannot put it back in. Now, time is your enemy on these technologies, my friend. Everyone I know who's gotten hit that sweet spot, figured it out, they dither, they get tied up in lame business. You know, small bean, small ball business plans, a few million here, 10 million there. Next thing you know, they're caught in the trap of all these pre-placed, you know, strategies that are out there being run by people who want to gather these things up. We're in possession of one brilliant man, the letter from the patent office. Saying no, this is a technology impacting the national security and we will not issue a patent and you cannot have it. We have that letter. It'll be in this movie. This is not a conspiracy theory. So the problem is, how do you get around that? Well, the worst thing you should do is listen to a conventional technologist, business person, a lawyer, or anyone else who would take a new version of an iPhone or a new version of a software program for Oracle or Microsoft and listen to anything they would tell you, because they have no idea what the strategic landscape is that you're stepping into. They don't know, and the inventors don't know. And that is the crux of the problem. It's a deficit of information about, because if this was so easy, to be honest with you, this would have happened in the 20s. Nikola Tesla had these things. Well, it didn't happen in the 20s. It's not happening in the 2020s. If we keep following the same strategy. Now, luckily, with the internet, with a huge amount of celebrities interested in the UFO issue, the new energy issue, the environmental issue, there is a strategy now. There's a door that's opened in the last 5 to 10 years. It did not exist 10 years ago, where something like this could be disclosed massively, and it would be known, but you cannot disclose one part of it. No one cares about a dog and pony show where you have something running on a desk. You know, the internet's filled with these videos. They're useless. Most of them are frauds anyway, frankly. I'm a big skeptic about 99% of them. But the ones that are real, you're not going to prove anything to a scientist or to the general public unless somebody else builds it, reproduces it, tests it. That's the sine qua non of science. The litmus test of science is that it's reproducible, right? So if it's not reproducible, who's going to believe you? You know, no one's going to believe me or you They wouldn't believe Albert Einstein if he hadn't put his, and other people could replicate the effect or the theory or what have you. So you're going to have to get sane about how science moves forward, technology moves forward, and the bigger the claim, this is the one thing I agree with Carl Sagan on, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So you've got to put the evidence out there for other people who are physicists and engineers and scientists and academics to reproduce and prove. Otherwise, they're just going to think it's a myth and a fraud and a trick. And rightly so, by honest with you, because you know, anything that claims that you're taking energy out of the vast infinite energy field of the zero point or quantum vacuum, but you wanted to keep how you're doing it secret, this is foolishness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I tell people, phase one would be this massive disclosure of it, open source it, no secrets, no holdbacks. Now, phase two, then that same group who understands the technology can then create specific items. Because once it is established as a science, and once it's established in the public as legitimate, and there are very famous people running their house or car on it, then you can go to, okay, a normal business plan. So that's phase two. You see, what everyone's doing, they're putting the cart before the horse. Because they're leaving out this key strategic step. And that's what we're trying to educate the general public on, but also the inventor community, the scientific community, who's routinely stumble across this phenomenon. Because one of the things to remember, in the 1800s, the real heyday of electromagnetism and experimentation was between the mid-1800s and early 1900s. That's when all the big breakthroughs happened. Electricity, this, that, you know, telegraph, you know, telecommunications, the telephone, what have you. And people routinely stumbled across this effect. They didn't know what it was. It's quantified now. Professor Casimir approved, and it was accepted and published in physics journals in the 40s and 50s about the zero point. Now, what has not been proven is that you can access it on a reliable basis to run your house or car or your boat or whatever it is. If that's happened, but the people, I have a friend who's a venture capitalist. He says, there's a direct relationship to how important the invention is and how crazy the inventor gets. So when it's something that important, the inventors and then the money people around them just go bonkers. They just go completely off the rails. And they're thinking not with their head, this head, they're thinking with the head somewhere south. You know, with the animal spirits, it's called, on Wall Street. So, you know, if you're really going to get this done, you're going to have to stay disciplined and intelligent. Now, on the government end of it, they don't know this exists. The members of the Senate and House and what have you, and the president. Their science people around them don't know it exists. There's not like there's some vast cover-up. Because if you don't know, you don't know.
Yeah, and also this is why scientific dogma, you know, academic dogma, they've come through the channels of academia and they don't believe it. They think it's pseudoscience, you know.
Sure. But yeah, and the conventional wisdom is that. And frankly, until there are systems that are can be widely disseminated, as I said, as a platform, as sort of a proof of principle that proves it, that anyone can reproduce and prove, the skepticism is frankly warranted. This is when I started the Disclosure Project in the 90s. It was called Project Starlight because it was a, not secret, but it was a confidential operation where I was trying to read in people in the administration and in your country and at the United Nations, hoping that I could go on with my life as a trauma doctor, an emergency doctor, not deal with this crap, excuse my language, and go have a normal life. But nobody wanted to do it, frankly. So here we are in 2023, 30 years later. But I think that, and from my perch where I sit, is that you have people like when all this stuff came out about the Tic Tac and the UFO, you know, off the coast of San Diego. Of course, I immediately looked at it with my view. Oh, that's from the Lockheed Skunk Works. It's actually made at the Palmdale facility underground. I have an aerial shot of the underground entrance point. I have it. Been there.
And is that something that you would be planning to release in the future?
Yes, it's going to be in this film.
You know, after
you,
after
you, this shit, I mean, this film is going to have part of the 119 cases that we have of these objects being downed and reverse engineered, and many, some of them are man-made ones, and we're going to have the schematics, we're going to have all that in there. Now, of course, it's a two-hour feature film, so it's not like, you know, now what we're creating is a compendium, and this is, I can announce this now. So I hired a man who had worked for Lockheed, not the Skunk Works, to work with me full-time, and about 11 months ago, something quite worrisome happened that the public doesn't know about yet. They're going to find out over the next 6 months. And that is the very people who had been tasked through the law passed in Congress to look into the UAP and UFO issue and issue a report every year on it. The top people who are in, you know, the most classified folks in that world had been taken out to facilities where they were shown a basically antique jet aircraft and were being gaslit, deceived. Now, luckily, these guys were smart enough to know they were being deceived. So here's the problem. If you and your colleagues and the people, the bosses you answer to in the constitutional government of the United States, you find out you're being absolutely gaslit and deceived. This cabal, this sociopathic criminal enterprise, way overplayed their hand with these guys. So after they were being misdirected by Elizondo and Chris Mellon and all these people for 3 or 4 years, finally these guys called me up and said, we need to meet. So I go in with a presidential level briefing dossier with the project code names and their location and where the facilities are and which are the contractors, which aerospace companies, which are the subcontractors, where is the gate, the northwest gate into the Nevada test range north of Nellis Air Force Base up above Area 51 and 52. And I just brought all this stuff into a secure facility and said, here, now how much of this do you want? We want everything. I said, well, you'll get everything. So now what we're doing right now, and we need people's help, is we are assembling that entire intelligence archive, but also actionable information going back from the 40s to right now, things going on right now. And it's being put into a massive hard drive system, which we are handing off, including the names of key whistleblowers, who the contractors are, where the offices are, where are the SCIFs and the underground, the deep underground military bases. So this is all being in excruciating, mind-numbing detail in the process of being handed off. I started that process in February. It's continuing and picking up speed now. That is how these guys have gotten on the inside. Now, they're not going to, you know, if you go knock on the door of some big corporate or a deep black program and say, pretty please, will you let us come in because we're TSA, top secret, special compartmented information, a special access project cleared, blah, blah, blah. They're going to say, go away. They're not going to give you anything. They will not give you the time of day. Now, most people listening say that cannot be true in a civilized society where the rule of law is supposed to prevail. I said, but it is true. And that's the problem. So if you're the chairs of the Senate Armed Services or Senate Intelligence Committee or the equivalent in your country, in the UK, and you make an inquiry, or you're the president, they're going to tell you either nothing or they're going to tell you what they want you to know. So this is where an independent outside entity, such as our group, has to be a check and balance. The media is not being a check and balance right now and haven't been for decades. So that's why we need help. Now, the good news is is that since we got this wall signed in, this bill signed into law right before Christmas, that protects whistleblowers and people with non-disclosure agreements. Like this one man I'm working with currently signed an 80-year non-disclosure agreement. Of course, he was in his 50s when he signed it. But he had baseline access across 18 of these unacknowledged special access projects, dealing with UFOs, the technologies, the ET craft. So I'm ushering him in. So what everyone needs to do who's listening, if you are someone in America or even in another country who have been firsthand directed, involved with these, contact me at SiriusDisclosure.com, S-I-R-I-U-S Disclosure.com. It will be handled confidentially. You will be checked out. And if you're willing, you can be confidentially walked into where you need to go to give your testimony. There's a mechanism now that's only a week or two old to do it. That's why we're going to be making an announcement in the next week or so, a big and global announcement about this. But I already have 1,100 names of many of these people I've worked with. Now, some I met with in the 90s have probably passed away now. But we're going to transfer all that data to these, I call them the white hats in these covert and the classified world, who are, they're just the best guys. And they're victims. They're scared to death. They have been on the run since I opened these doors to them. They have been targeted. We got put on the watch group list, which is the kill list. Doesn't deter me at all. I've been on threatened like that since 92 and 93. But I think that this progress is something like I haven't seen in 30 years. Not because of what you're reading in Politico or on CNN, but this other, what's really going on. So there's the dog and pony show you're going to hear about out through Era. And then there's what's actually going on.
Yeah, I'd like to kind of circle back on this because, you know, I try and remain relatively neutral. I do have my opinion.
Oh, nobody's
doing things that happen. No, but what I mean is that I try and take in like the different opinions, the different movements, the things that are happening right now. And Chris Mellon, for example, someone that I've spoken back and forth with quite a lot, and I've actually spoken with John Warner as well. And I know you had an interview with John Warner. I actually interviewed him a while back as well. Chris really doesn't strike me as someone who's being disingenuous. I feel that he is actually trying to push within the boundaries that he's allowed to in a kind of bureaucratic sense. And he recently put out an article basically validating the Wilson document, saying that Eric was the author, and has, you know, kind of pushed for this idea that, hey, look, we're dealing with an extraterrestrial situation here in so many words. So would you mind just kind of giving me your opinion on why you feel someone like Chris is maybe not being as genuine as I feel he might be?
I think that if you have the kind of access he has, and I know that John Warner the Fourth, who was Senator John Warner's son, and by the way, Paul Mellon's grandson, the guy who helped start the CIA and all this started, and he feels this way. You have a moral obligation to not play games with something like this. So you don't go and sit with senators and say, gee, maybe this is from China, or we don't know what this is. When you do know what it is, if you know what it is, all that kind of gaslighting and perseverating and dissembling and half-truths and mealy-mouth, no. I mean, you know, this we're 75 years into a cover-up that has cost the world its future and is now an existential threat to the human future. This is not the time for playing those games. So I know I can be very brusque. I'm an emergency doctor. And if you've got a bleed in your brain and you're going to die in 30 minutes, I'm not going to tell you got a migraine and go home and take 2 aspirin. So, which would kill you, by the way, because it's a blood thinner. So you have to, you know, I just think this is not the time for those games.
I can understand.
Now, so, and so here's my conclusion. I don't know him personally. I do know that if you say things that are demonstrably not true, such as we don't know what these are, we don't know where they come from, we don't know that the U.S. covert aerospace companies, I'm like my uncles, Northrop Grumman, have worked on and developed black money research projects that have man-made UFOs zipping around and have had since the 50s. All this is out there and has been dispositively proven by testimony, documents, everything that we put out in the Disclosure Project for 30 years. To then go up and have access to key members of the U.S. government and say things that are provably false, this is a problem. I don't care who you are. I don't have a beef with him as a person. I have a beef with anyone who does that, because if you have that kind of access and are from the Mellon family and have had those senior positions in government, meaning you, I have supported you with my tax dollars, since I've never gotten an Indian head nickel from the government and paid millions of dollars into the government for taxes, my view is you have a moral obligation to either be quiet or speak the truth, but don't do anything other than that. So that is my beef with, okay. And I think that we have to, you know, look, having been presidents and CIA directors, I really, you know, people who want to step in and then appear all over the world as if they are some kind of authority on this subject and put out one statement after another that isn't true. Now, for example, one of the key statements that got, now he's backed off some of this, but when he was with, there was a boy that I had sort of mentored back in the early 2000s named Tom DeLong, who was a singer for Blink-182. And he'd stay at my house, and, you know, I got him very well. But, you know, when all that started happening, after Unacknowledged hit 750 million views, by the way, and they stand up this organization, and what happens is that they're putting all this stuff out to the public of, one, they're a threat to the national security, implying there's some alien threat. There is not. The threat, let me quote, I know people don't like facts. It's very politically incorrect to talk about facts in America. But here's a fact. We published, and you can look it up, the letter from the first director of the CIA to the New York Times in 1961. After Eisenhower said, beware the military-industrial complex, Admiral Roscoe P. Allen Keeter wrote a letter saying, not only is the UFO issue real, but the secrecy around the UFOs is a threat to the national security. So yes, there's a huge national security threat going on, but it's not from someone from outer space. It's from a clandestine operation that is rogue and illegal, that is destroying the biosphere, has killed people to keep their secrets. And that is a threat to the national security and to world security. So people say, how do you know that? I said, because the first CIA director trying to come clean and cleanse his soul said so in an open letter to the New York Times 61 years ago, before you were born. So again, this isn't my opinion. This is a fact from a man who was there. Remember, the CIA was formed as a response to the Roswell event. And it was the Air Force broke off from the Army Air Force. Those were all things that happened in the wake of what happened in the 40s with these ET craft. So the history of this is quite clear in my sense. And there are people who have warned us of the threat, but the threat isn't coming from Alpha Centauri or another galaxy. It's coming from inside, which is where the worst threats always come from. Good news, the senior people in the U.S. government now understand what I just told you. They know it, and it's been proven to them. They've been victims of it. And there's no more, they're not going to be deluded by this anymore.
Well, it's good to hear that, because, I mean, I don't think we can say with confidence that, you know, all intelligence in the universe that reaches interstellar and beyond would be benevolent, but I don't like the tone of militarism and defending against the outsiders. You know, this does feel dangerous, and it feels like an oversimplification of what's likely a very complex issue.
Yes, but let's take the position you just took. It's sort of agnostic. If you have technologies that are 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 9th years, 100,000 to 100 million or more years at more advanced than what you and I are using right now, and you were malevolent, it's point set match. Part of the problem is all the science fiction and all the UFO, you know, subculture stuff. Civilizations that would have that level of technology, if they were malevolent or had any bad intention towards this earth and our species, it'd be over. and it'd be over in 3 nanoseconds. Because one of the problems is people, you know, we're talking about technologies that were extant in the late 1800s up through the mid 20th century, including anti-gravity. Now, when you start talking about space-time transferring through space-time, beyond the speed of light, transdimensional physics, and you have that ability for entire spacecraft, people, space centers to go from point A to B, you have that as a reliable, reproducible technology for millennia. You know, look, the state of human civilization would be like slicking off a flea. So I tell people, it's great to have those fantasies because everyone loves to have someone to hate, and humans love to have be divided into warring camps. It's our original sin, in my opinion. It's where racism, homophobia, all that stuff comes from. Someone wants to feel better than someone else. So you have to have, it's not politically correct to be blatantly a racist anymore. Well, in some quarters it may be, but it's okay to be an interstellar racist and say, oh, there's this species out here. I don't see any evidence for it, but even if there was, what are you going to do about it? And this is the, you know, this was one of the conversations at the end with Admiral Wilson. He says, well, the best thing I know I have is a V-2 stealth bomber. And I have found out there's a secret group that have things that can do circles around it. And that there are interstellar, there, that's way beyond that. I said, yes, you're correct. Now, you know, he was the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, a very similar conversation a few years later happened with the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency when I was briefing him. And in America, just so people know, the top of the intelligence, you have the CIA director, civilian, but the top of all military intelligence is the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, not CIA. And so, you know, I mean, it was a very long briefing at his conference room at the Pentagon. And he had run into the same thing. He had been denied access, and but he came to the same conclusion. I said, boy, these are so advanced. So, you know, obviously, if they were a threat. I said, yeah, and the threat is the clandestine human operations, because they're the ones who can pull the trigger on false flag and other operations that will keep all of you deceived. And so it has come to pass. I think this is where, you know, the security of the future security of the world is not only involving, you know, obvious discussions of peace and weapons, but also the technologies that could save the biosphere, but also in world poverty. Because I think before the biosphere collapses, we're in probably bigger risk. Of the 3 billion people, The Economist, the British publication that I read, recently came out where the 3 billion people don't have any means to cook their food. So they're cutting down old growth rainforests or desert scrub to make charcoal or to cook. That's 3 billion of the 7.9 billion people. That's not a sustainable or just civilization. And if there's no justice, there's no peace. So all of that can't be fixed with a windmill or a solar panel. It can be fixed with these technologies, but it means the termination of the 150-year industrial revolution, antique technologies of coal and gas and oil and what have you, and nuclear power. With nuclear power, you don't get energy from the atom. You're actually just creating heat from fission and running a steam engine like a choo-choo train in the 1840s going to California. That's all of a nuclear power plant is. Except you have the added bonus. While there's no carbon, you have a million years worth of radioactive waste that causes cancer and kills life. So, and how do we warrant a million years worth of deadly toxic material when our civilization is only a few thousand years old? So I think that, you know, these solutions have to be, this is why the lost century to me is sort of like the next step in, you know, we have these investigations going on in Congress. We have millions of people doing CE5 peaceful contact to show a nice face of humanity to the cosmos instead of just some warmongering twit. But the technologies are still in this box. And there are brilliant civilian, not covert programs, scientists who keep discovering this phenomenon. But they keep making the same mistakes. What we want to do is provide a sort of a guide pathway of okay, you come across some of these technologies, now what? You know, and the now what, the answer to that needs to be informed from the 30 years of research and experience collectively our team has with why everyone has made these same reproducible errors. So my hope and my prayer is that this film, when it comes out later this year, we hope in May, I'm not going to promise that, but Hollywood being what it is. But if it is out by May, we're also planning later in May, early June, to have another National Press Club event. And at that point, I hope to reveal this entire intelligence archive, a sanitized version of it that has sensitive people's names out, or their DD-214s with that we have, which of course has their social security numbers and all that. I have vast files like this, over 1,000 people, whistleblowers. But the rest of it, except that sensitive personal information that when I tell people I'll keep your information confidential, I do. I'm a doctor, so we're accustomed to doing this every single day. But the rest of it, we want to make available to the public and to the media. Anybody know a good website developer who can handle 8 terabytes of data? That's what we're talking about, 8 terabytes. Big.
You know, you've brought it up a couple of times, so I'd like to kind of just quickly highlight it. You know, recently I flew to Florida and I met Oak Shannon, the former special projects manager for Los Alamos National Labs, and one of the names that was mentioned in the Admiral Wilson documents. Very kind person, both him and his wife Linda, and he told me on the record during an interview we did recently that Admiral Wilson, you know, did call him up to ask about Eric Davis. Oak Shannon confirmed that he vouched for Eric Davis to Admiral Wilson. Everything about Oak Shannon in those documents has since been confirmed by Oak Shannon on our interview, and the documents themselves, as you know, have been inserted into the congressional record. I would not expect you to be able to confirm the legitimacy of the transcript itself or whether the meeting actually took place, because the alleged meeting has nothing to do with you in a direct sense. However, your name is mentioned in these documents, and so for the sake of clarification, I think it's important that we just get your side of this on the record. So I would just like to be able to ask you, first of all, whether or not you personally know Dr. Eric W. Davis.
Yeah. I didn't work with him day in and day out, but I did work with him. I know him fairly well.
May I ask how you first got to know him?
In mutual projects, mm-hmm. mutual acquaintances, meetings, things of that sort.
And do you personally know Admiral Thomas R. Wilson?
Yes, I do. But I know him, and of course I know of him. But I read somewhere that his response was, "Oak who?" And I thought that was kind of funny. as I mentioned to you, I consider myself eminently forgettable. So I'm sure that my memory of him is stronger than his memory of me, because mm-hmm. he became a flag officer. I went off and did weird things on top of a mesa in New Mexico. So, so I would expect that he would not remember me as well as I remember him.
Did Admiral Wilson get in contact with you in 2001 or 2002, inquiring into the background and overall trustworthiness of Dr. Eric Davis?
Earlier than that.
Was it earlier than that? My apologies.
Yeah. No, it's... We moved to Florida in 2000, and Linda's listening in the background so she can yell at me and tell me if I'm wrong.
Hey, Linda.
2001. I had had a heart attack and had actually died on the ICU table, and had my own out-of-body experience, by the way.
Yes, I want to talk to you about that a little bit later on. Absolutely.
I was eventually forced to retire medically because I could not get back in the saddle, even remote work. And I was at home. I was having several complications out of that experience, out of that problem, kept recurring over the months. This was in like May of 99, honey?
Yeah.
May of 99. And throughout the summer, I was having these other problems being cropped up for that. And so I was at home. Actually, I was actually writing, trying to write a novel about the destruction of the Twin Towers. This was in 1999. I had to trash that when it actually happened.
Wow.
I got this phone call, and it was from Admiral Wilson. And he asked me, now, this was not a short conversation. I was recuperating. Mm-hmm. I was able to carry on this conversation on the phone, but I wasn't able to do much else at that point. And we had a discussion, and one of the things he wanted to know was, could he trust Eric Davis? And I think he may have even mentioned Hal Puthoff and one or two other people. And I mentioned that, yes, I believe that Eric Davis was an honorable and conscientious scientist, and that he would honor any restrictions the Admiral might put on him. And I thought it would be safe for him to contact him.
Do you think we'll ever get anything from Admiral Wilson himself?
Look, I mean, he was threatened with demotion and threatened mm-hmm. otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So many of the men and women, mostly men, that I work with, some in the last few months have had lethal force threatened at them or their families. I mean, we're talking about a nasty, thuggish, I use the word thugs for this clandestine, illegal clandestine group. And so I know the risks that I've taken. I've accepted them. And luckily, I don't need money. I don't need fame. My children and my grandchildren and my wife are taken care of, and I've already taken care of all that. So they kill me, come at it. But, you know, God help you, because I've got a dead man trigger with stuff that no one in the world's ever seen that'll hit the internet immediately. That's in multiple places and multiple confidential people holding it. So that's my, you know, ace, because they know what I have. This cabal of sociopaths and murderers know what I have. But the other thing is that it's that's why I don't judge. You know, I think it, you know, at this stage, now, let me be clear. This is very early stages of any official government really looking into this. Because Project Blue Book was a dog and pony show. Right now, Arrow is a dog and pony show. It's sound and fury signifying nothing. Because the people in there have deliberately been kept in the dark, so they have plausible deniability. But the real action that's happening, where people are being walked in who have testimony, those people can do it. They can do it confidentially, and they need to contact me ASAP soon, because that's beginning this month, January, February, on through into the spring. The other thing that I say to people is that one of the things I'm advocating for, two things actually. One is a part of a bill to be introduced this year to provide executive protection, martial protection, whatever, to people, physical protection. And that would be official and provide it. And the other is amnesty for very senior people that I know who've been involved in these projects at the corporate level and in the government level, but who have liability under the treason, under, you know, for treason, but also financial liability. There's one executive that we've been, had reached out to us, who major executive, major company, hundreds of millions of dollars he made from these operations. And he's elderly. He doesn't want to lose that for his family. And I think, look, you know, I mean, it's a complicated problem I'm dealing with here. And so what I'm advising the people in the U.S. government is an eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind. We need to get some of these people at the very senior level to come forward. But if you do a scorched earth approach, we're just going to try you for treason, or we're going to seize your assets under RICO, racketeering influence, corrupt organization laws. But then, you know, they could hit the button and blow the whole system. They got that amount of power. So let's be smart about this. So I'm going to recommend the first installment, in my view, is what just got signed 2 weeks ago. And that is the whistleblower protection. And, you know, I was working very closely with the main people who wrote that.
Is there anything you can say on that? Because I've, like, with respect, there will be some people that would challenge that claim. Is there anything that you could give us just in terms of specifics, just to bolster that?
Well, I mean, they can look up, you know, the people in the Congress, and the president signed it.
I know, but I mean, in terms of, see, you've been directly communicating with Senator Marco Rubio, Kirsten Gillibrand, people like that.
I don't talk about people I'm working with. I talk about what we're doing. But the reason that this has gotten this far in the last year is that the assets I've given to their investigators and the key people, not Arrow, has allowed them to get in the system. They're on the inside now.
So now there are a few dozen people who are currently operative in these programs coming forward, and we want it to be a lot more. So that's what we're working on. You know, there are people who have been recently retired. Some are currently involved. But if they're still living and they have actionable intelligence and information or documents, and they're firsthand, we don't care about a rumor of a rumor of a rumor. That's not going to go anywhere. Then they need to contact me. Because if they go through channels, they're probably going to be diverted into a dog and pony show. Because remember, that's how things operate. You have counterintelligence operatives embedded at every level of this, everywhere. But there are some good, very good people who are seriously making progress. And I think that's it's wonderful news for the UFO community and the disclosure community. You know, I founded the whole disclosure movement back in the late 90s and early 2000s, but I've never seen anything like this in 30 years. And so I'm very, very optimistic or hopeful. I'm very hopeful. And I think the people who are making great strides are courageous, amazingly courageous guys that are going the distance. And I'm part of their team, and they're wonderful people, but I don't betray confidences, mm-hmm. as you know. Mm-hmm. I will say this. You had a gentleman on your show named Admiral Bobby Ray Edmund.
I was going to get into that with you, so I'm glad you brought him up.
Okay. And you don't know this. It happened a couple of days. Shortly after I first met with these senior folks who were really in charge of this. They asked me in the first meeting to give a list of the senior people on the committee that deal with this issue in the deep black world. And one of the top people on that list is Admiral Bobby Ray Inman. And he's been involved for decades he's 90 years old. Interestingly, he then went out of his way to appear and denied, you know, oh, no. And well, you know, now this conversation was happening in a secure SCIF, a secure communication information facility, where I was providing all this information, documents, assets, facilities list, the corporate list, the names, the project code numbers, all that we have acquired over the last couple of decades. And of course, they wanted to know, who out there? I said, I started naming them. And of course, I said, absolutely. Of course, Senator Barry Goldwater, who had been a senior senator for the Republican Party, ran for president in 64, and John McCain took his seat. And back in the 90s, I was at Senator Goldwater's house, and I'm sitting in his living room, and this issue comes up. Of course, I was there because he wanted to know about the UFO issue, because he had been inquiring about it for decades. And he told me the story of General Curtis LeMay, whose nickname was Bomba Back to the Stone Age LeMay, because he wanted to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam, as you remember. Well, you weren't alive then, but I was a child at that time. But I remember the 1964 election. I was like 9 years old. And that was a real issue. That's how President Johnson won, because they were showing these pictures of mushroom clouds coming up all over the world, because we tripped our way into World War III. But Barry Goldwater lost that election, but he stayed lifetime interest in the UFO issue, because he had heard, he was a general in the Air Force Reserves. He had been a World War II guy. And so I'm sitting in his living room, and this issue, you know, we get deeper and deeper into it. And finally, you know, he tells me a story how General LeMay said to him, and I thought he was joking. He said, I turned to Curtis LeMay, and General LeMay, I want to get into the blue room at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where he had heard that there were extraterrestrial materiel and stuff. And there is. I know we have a lot of people who've been in there. I've been at Wright-Patt meeting with the senior people there. And and he said, Curtis LeMay turned to him and said, excuse my language, but this is how Barry Goldwater, Senator Goldwater spoke. God damn it, Barry, I can't even get into that area. And if you ever ask me about this again, I will personally see you are court-martialed out of the Air Force Reserves. And I said, oh, he had to be joking. He said, and Senator Goldwater goes, oh, no, he was serious as a heart attack. So I go, well, look, I said, that doesn't surprise me after what I've gone through with, you know, the CIA director and all these other people being blocked. And you were a senior senator, the most senior in the sense of head of the Republican Party, which is the usually the pro-military wing of the political parties in the United States. So he said, well, how can I help you? I said, well, I really need to get to some of the senior people in this organization. And so I started naming people. He didn't know this one. He didn't know that one. Finally, I said, Admiral Bobby Ray Inman. He said, oh, Bobby Ray, we've been friends for years. I said, well, he's only like MJ 12 number two or whatever. I mean, and he says, really? I said, he says, well, I'll give him a call for you. He got back to me after that and said, and his daughter called me also and said, Dr. Greer, we can't make any more inquiries like that. And the fear of God was put into Senator Goldwater. And he was not someone you intimidated easily. He was an old lion from way back. And I went, I understand. I never ask anyone. This is why I don't put any pressure on Admiral Wilson. Anyone who gets rocked back where they think they and their family's lives are at risk, and they're not willing to still push through. Now, I push through. I've been threatened for decades. And it's a big, there's the door. Don't let it hit you in the ass as you leave. I mean, that's kind of my personality. Hey, you know, emergency doctors, you got gangbangers coming in with tech tins in your face and semi-automatic. This is America, right? So it's like we're not nancing around in penny loafers like, you know, some lawyer somewhere. So, oops, sorry I said that. But the point I'm making is Barry Goldwater was no, you know, shrinking violet. But he was like, whatever, I don't know exactly what was said when he tried to get Admiral Inman to cooperate with what we were doing, but it was, it put the fear of God in him and his family, by the way.
Yeah.
This I know for a fact. I don't make up stuff that I don't have firsthand knowledge of. And one of the things I get frustrated with the UFO grist mill. It's like when all that information came out about Admiral Wilson, I'm going, I disclosed that information 20 years ago. What, this is news? See, the thing is, when people actually are doing what we're doing and you tell the truth, people can't believe it's true. But it is true. Every word I've told you is true. And people go, oh, that can't be true. And I could give a rat's ass what people think. You know, all I care about is the truth. And I will share the truth. People ask me a question, I'm going to tell them the truth. Mm. Now, that it disturbs people because most people are going to talk half-truths, partial-truths, this, that. The only where I draw the line is disclosing the names of the people who need to be kept confidential that we're actively involved with. And so that's why this big archive is intelligence data that we have. That's what'll be taken out because I'm not going to betray a confidence.
Well, I don't know if you finished that interview with Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, but I feel like his body language gave him away a little bit in that conversation because, he was, you know, and all due respect to the man. We had a, you know, polite conversation, but he was very relaxed. He was very, you know, laid back mm-hmm. as we were talking about his career and mm-hmm. we're talking about geopolitics. Mm-hmm. Once it mm-hmm. got to the UFOs, arms crossed, touching mm-hmm. his ear, touching his nose, shaking his head. I mean, I'm not a body language specialist, but sometimes I don't think you need to be. that was quite blatant that he didn't feel very comfortable when I brought up Bob Exler, especially Bob Exler.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you can just help me clarify something, because when I was doing some background research on you, I came across a fascinating little segment from a documentary. It was a segment of an interview that you had in 1989 with a man called Bob Exler. Do you remember speaking to a man called Bob Exler?
Yeah,
and During this conversation, he asked you whether you believed that the recovered vehicles would ever be made available for technical research outside of the military circles. And your response to this was, 10 years ago, I would have said no, but whether time has evolved and they're beginning to become more open on it, it's a possibility. So obviously, correct me if I'm wrong, but it just seems like you're suggesting here that you're aware of retrieved UFOs being studied by the military.
No, the answer was no. I would not. It would not. Absolutely, we're no retrieved UFOs. I have high confidence.
A close confidant of George Bush and a man well acquainted with Area 51 was Admiral Bob Inman. His credentials are impeccable. He was director of both Naval Intelligence and the National Security Agency, as well as deputy director of the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA. In a telephone conversation with Bob Exler in 1989, he referred to recovered vehicles becoming available for research.
Do you anticipate that any of the recovered vehicles would ever be become available for technological research outside of the military circles?
Again, I honestly don't know. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, the answer would have been no.
Yeah.
Whether as time has evolved, they're beginning to become more open on it. There's a possibility.
It seems like you're suggesting here that you're aware of retrieved UFOs being studied by the military.
No, the answer was no. I would not. We're not. Absolutely, we're no retrieved UFOs. I have high confidence that was not the case. Hardware that ended up out of Site 51 was our own planned collection platforms that we didn't want Soviets to know about.
Well, Admiral Inman convinced me that these vehicles were not manufactured by human technology, so that's pretty conclusive for me.
And, you know, I think most people are aware of the recording between Bob Exler and Inman, where Inman literally does say that he, you know, doesn't know if maybe in 10 years' time maybe they'll talk about it, but he acknowledges that they do have crash retrievals, and, you know, this is a guy that's been close to the center of the mandala.
Well, he was deputy director of CIA and the director of the National Security Agency. Mm-hmm. But now those same positions, I know people who've been in those positions that don't know anything.
Of course.
But then he went on to the board of SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation, which is one of the crown jewels of the contracting world, along with Lockheed Skunk Works and Booz Allen Hamilton and Northrop Grumman and E-Systems and Raytheon and EG&G. We know who they are. We know where the facilities are. I have many people who work in the facilities on the materials and on the man-made craft. So, you know, all that's being shared with the people who need to know. And frankly, that's why the Lost Century that's coming out is going to include some of that. But then eventually this intelligence archive and information, if we can get someone to help us build this website, I mean, it's got to be blockchain protected. It's going to get taken down. But I want the world's media and research community to have access to all this stuff. So we've been digging stuff out of my archives and a bunch of other archives now for a year and a half. But we've really picked up the pace because now we're at a critical juncture where people in the U.S. government want all of it. And so I'm providing everything to them, everything I have.
After, because I mean, you've been doing this for a long time. After cultivating such a large pool of insiders and information, I would just like to get your current take on what is achievable within the world of classified aerospace and black budget technology, because there's still a lot of debate in the field about, you know, the overall capabilities of human tech in comparison to the capabilities of, let's say, a legitimate UFO. So just based on what you've been told over the years, where do you think we are with these things?
We're not at parity, but we're close. Now, that's why when Ben Rich, who was dead at Lockheed Skunk Works,
mm-hmm.
And I have a new contact for him who actually worked with him, had his private cell number. He was an early U-2 spy plane pilot, then worked for the Skunk Works, worked with him, worked in Area 51, 52. I just met with him in Washington, and he's one of the gentlemen I'm going to walk through into the arms of these folks now that this law's passed. He's been watching my work for 20-some years, was waiting for an official pathway. But, we know that when Ben Rich said to the last week of his life to Jim Goodall that, whatever you can imagine, you've seen in Star Trek, we've done it. We already have it.
We got things flying around in a desert that are 50 years beyond what you can comprehend, or something along those lines.
No, thousands of years.
Yeah.
So it's not at the level of Interstellar, but it's way advanced. And now, in terms of communications and surveillance, that is at the level of transdimensional. So there's a distinction here between a passive and an active system. An active system is you have a craft here and you put it out, you go out to Andromeda Galaxy 2.5 million light years. That we don't have. But what we do have are the ability to influence or surveil that far out in real time, going bypassing linear space time and the speed of light. So
like there are quantum communication, quantum computing and radio communication.
Using non-locality and entanglement and so-called longitudinal or scalar systems. I won't get into the physics of it all, but I've seen them and we know them. Problem with it, those technologies are in the hands of the worst people and they can be turned into an act of war. You've heard of Havana syndrome, but they're much more advanced than Havana syndrome type technologies. And they can be used as both surveillance and this is why you go into a skiff and it's electronically sealed and everyone's cell phones are taken. Everything that's being said and done in that facility is known in real time by this group that have these very advanced technologies. And that's been a very hard thing for people in the U.S. government to get their minds around because their SecOps, their security operations and protocols, require them to do certain things, which of course I always comply with, but encrypted this and that, but it's spitting in the face of a Category 5 hurricane. It has zero effect at preventing your adversary, in this case, to know everything you're doing in real time. And remember, my military advisor, one of them who was at the meeting with Admiral Wilson, was read into a technology back in the 70s at White Oak Naval Facility outside D.C. up in Maryland. It's closed now. And it was basically a console, and it had been there for a while, since the 60s, where it could penetrate what's called the white noise of space-time and target any volume of space, outer space, underground, your living room, and extract anything that was going on now or that's embedded in the fabric of space-time on a quantum level, what happened last year, 10 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 10 million years ago. And that was fully operational in the 70s. But I've been read into these sort of technologies that clandestine, very high-tech groups have had since the big breakthroughs happened in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's okay. When the Iron Curtain fell down on things like electrogravitics and advanced propulsion physics.
Exactly. And that we're actually the lost century that's coming out. You guys are going to see that. We're going to actually document craft, and we have the artist drawings and accounts and military accounts of those things from the 50s and 60s. And remember, the ARV that Brad Sorensen saw at the 1988 air show. I have a transcript of people who were there saying that the components on the inside of that thing were Mercury era. Late 50s, early 60s. Now, this is in 88. So it was almost like a museum piece. But it had been around our solar system, zipping around, had burn mark. So this was an electrogravitic anti-grav. So now, what do I think about what needs to come out when? Unfortunately, because the world has become more unstable instead of more stable, I agree. I met with a colonel who was in charge of future technologies for the Air Force, which is a euphemism for stuff they already have that they don't want to acknowledge, because they always make up a fake name. That's a diversion. You know, that you have to understand how the mind trick works with intelligence. And he goes, I said, look, we just at this stage want to bring out something that sits in the hood of your car or at your house, runs the house. But things that fly, I acknowledge, are potentially and are a missile delivery system. Mm-hmm. So that a terrorist in the Congo could put something over downtown DC in 2 or 3 seconds. Not minutes. Boom.
Yep.
Now, so this is where you get into a very serious conversation about global security, and that, but it's a bit of a chicken egg, because the more we delay all this information coming out, the more the world becomes unstable. There's more terrorism. There's more war. Look what's going on with Ukraine and Germany and gas and oil in your country. So this whole situation is only going to get worse. So we need to at least make the first initial step to disclose the energy generation technologies that could save the biosphere and end poverty globally within 20 years or so. Now, the next step would be, okay, now let's have a conversation about the electrogravitics. And, you know, for those to actually come out and be used in everyday use, there would have to be global consensus and enforcement that they're not used in a weapon system. Because if they're using a weapon system, forget an ICBM, it takes however many minutes to go from Russia to New York or London. This is a total game changer. So I commiserate with the people who have inherited this mess, you see. So now, because of what was done in the 40s and 50s, the secrecy in a very real way, what Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter, the first CIA director, said is true, that the secrecy around the UFO issue is a threat to the national security. So when you begin to really unpack that, you have to then look at this whole big picture of the state of the world, the poverty, the pollution, the biosphere, the oceans dying, mass extinction of species. This is all part and parcel of this whole same problem. But because the whole thing has been kept secret, it's going to make it harder for the electrogravitics to come out. Because the electrogravitics, the anti-grav stuff, that coming out, my friend, now we're talking about, it'd be great because you could travel from London to where I am here out in the mountains of Virginia. We're at our retreat center. We have a 10-bedroom retreat center we just finished that people can rent and do CE5 out here.
Oh, sounds great.
Yeah, you should do it. And so what happens? Well, we have to walk before we run and run before we levitate. So our civilization isn't walking, it's flat on its back going down. So we need to stand up and begin to walk forward. But I think there has to be some wise heads that prevail to look at how this is done, when it's done, what point comes out. Because if you bring out the whole thing in a world that is still at each other's throats, where you have psychopaths and sociopaths running many of the world's governments.
We'll destroy each other. We'll destroy ourselves.
Of course. And that's the genie that got out of the bottle with atomic and then nuclear weapons, right? Mm-hmm. So then you add to that things that go at that speed. You know, forget supersonic. Forget rockets. I mean, rockets were cool in the 40s. We're talking way past that. So that is a legitimate national security concern. It doesn't mean that you just deny it exists. It means you talk about it. Everybody knows a hydrogen bomb, a thermonuclear weapon, is a national security concern. You don't deny it exists. You don't deny the laws of physics. So, but you have to balance this. But if you keep everything secret, the ET presence, then no one trusts anybody. So you can't just lie for 75 years and think there are no consequences. And if you suppress all of the technologies, especially the energy generation ones, for corrupt reasons, then you're actually creating a situation where it makes further disclosures, such as the propulsion systems, impossible. because the world isn't stable and it's not peaceful. And it's not prosperous and it's not just. There's no way you can, I mean, you know, Westerners are so narcissistic. We forget that half the world, 48% of the world doesn't have plumbing. They don't have running water. All right. So we live in this luxury. Even the poorest people on welfare in the United States would be middle class or rich in many parts of the world. And so we forget that the world is a globe and that these civilizations from other star systems are watching this horror show, frankly. Everybody says, why don't they just land? I said, are you crazy? Take a look around. So we have to, and that's the other big initiative that we have to do is show a part of ourselves, a better, a higher nature and consciousness to the ETs and say, look, not everyone on this planet is a sociopathic, megalomaniacal money whore, you know, grubbing for money and destroying the biosphere. There are good people. Most humans are good people. And we need to show that face because, unfortunately, when I started this project in 1990, the whole thing was the Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind initiative. And so we have an app, CE5 Contact. Anyone can get it. It's an entire training program in there. And now there are millions of people doing it. Because I think that at the same time we resolve these governmental and technological issues, we have to mind what is the guiding consciousness behind this. It has to be something philanthropic, altruistic, something bigger than ourselves. It's got to be something peaceful, and it's got to have, our vision has to be looking at the far horizon of a time when humanity is peaceful and then can become interplanetary. And by the way, that's what these ETs are waiting for. And the ones that don't like how we're behaving have us under a type of cosmic quarantine, because we are considered a malignant influence in the universe right now. And frankly, we are.
See, yeah, this is an aspect of the subject, although I suppose I wouldn't even really call it an aspect, because I think this is actually the keystone that is too often overlooked when attempting to understand not only the UFO phenomenon, but I suppose anomalous or so-called paranormal phenomenon in general, and that is human consciousness, the science or physics of consciousness, our inability to truly comprehend our own ability to comprehend.
Yes.
You know, this is a mystery in of itself, but it also has distinct correlations with the existence of UFOs. So how do you view consciousness and the UFO subject in the wider quest to bring these issues into a clearer perspective? What's the link between these issues, and why does certain phenomena, in your opinion, respond to human signals from the mind? To bring that into a more succinct question for you, where do you stand on the connections between consciousness, UFOs, and other paranormal behavior?
Well, I don't use the word paranormal. Mm. To me, that's just, it's normal, except people don't understand
it. Right. It's, yeah.
So, okay. I'm being a little bit cheeky, but.
It's okay. You can be pedantic if you want to be.
And I actually don't believe in metaphysics. It's physics, and it's all physics, and including the science of consciousness. And, you know, before I was a doctor, I was a meditation teacher and taught Sanskrit and meditation and the Vedas. And thank God I did that before I went into medicine. In my misspent youth, while everybody else was chasing skirts and dropping acid and getting drunk, I was meditating 8 hours a day and learning what are called the cities. And you realize that there is a physics of science of consciousness where the mind can actually affect something to levitate or to levitate the body or to teleport or to remote view a distant place. I learned all that when I was 18, 19, 20. And that, I believe, is the Rosetta Stone of understanding extraterrestrial. Because if you're going beyond the speed of light, you're not using this gadget you and I are talking on at the speed of light. You're using an interface of both technological and conscious technologies. So back in 91, I wrote a paper about consciousness-assisted technologies and technologies that assist consciousness. It goes both ways. And that is the, let's call it the central operating system of all interstellar extraterrestrial. Now, there are some civilizations out there that don't have that ability, but they're not traveling physically through space. They may be able to travel mentally. And this gets complicated. Because everyone thinks that everything out there is at the same level of evolution, and it is not. So to get into a little more detail on it, any civilization capable of going from one star system to here, their communication systems have to operate in real time. They do. And to do that, they cannot operate at the speed of light. They have to operate the speed of thought, the quanta of thought. Now, I know Elon Musk with Neuralink, there are a lot of people studying this, kind of quantum consciousness and quantum computing and all that. But these civilizations have already mastered that capability. So they have innate capabilities. It's called telepathic. But they definitely have technologies that interface with consciousness and thought from one node, from one point to another, perfectly. So that is the foundation of CE5 contact in the app. That's why the ability to be in a conscious state, remote view, and then connect. You're not just connecting with their innate consciousness. You're also connecting with their craft or their technological interface through clear intended thought. I call it coherent thought sequencing. So that becomes a very key part of what people have to understand if they say, oh, they want to have contact experience with actual ETs. You have to understand what is their scientific paradigm. They're not using a 20th century and early 21st century electromagnetic paradigm at the speed of light. Because if they are, they're not interstellar. A priori, if they're going from one star system to another, per force, they must be able to do things in real time across vast light years of distance. So just so your listeners understand, if you're from the Andromeda galaxy, like this one ET that we've had contact with out in Joshua Tree, Bijou, 2.5 million light years away. And that's distance. So that takes, at the speed of light, 186,000 miles a second. It would take 2.5 million years for this signal you and I are using to get there. And then for it to be answered, you say, hey, how you doing? For them to say, fine, how are you today? That takes another 2.5 million years, 5 million years round trip at the speed of light. So we know that that is not viable if you're talking about an interstellar civilization. Therefore, all interstellar civilizations are transdimensional. Now, this gets into what people call paranormal, because when you cross out of the linear cosmos and you cross through other dimensions, you're running into other dimensions that involve other phenomena, astral beings, ghosts, this, that, and the other thing. So there's a nexus where all this comes together. And that's why a lot of my teachings in the last few years have been about this cosmology, because the cosmology we need to begin to understand, that's both conscious and physics, needs to begin to really be put into an applied system. So the CE5 contact teams, they're just using these protocols, but behind it is this deep analysis of the fact that if it's an interstellar civilization capable of going from there to here, and they've gotten here, they're not doing that at the speed of light. I mean, even you know, 1% of the distance across the Milky Way, our own galaxy, it's 100,000 light years across, would be 1,000 light years. So something very close to us in our galaxy at the speed of light would take 1,000 years for a signal. And 1,000, it's the time since the birth of Christ. Mm-hmm. You know, interestingly, this conversation, which I know sounds rather bizarre and arcane, is what came up at the meeting with the CIA director. Not the CIA director. His wife was the chief operating officer of the National Academy of Sciences, very prestigious scientific. And she immediately asked, how could they be communicating? And I said, well, you know, honestly, I thought, well, do I tell her the truth and sound like a crank? Or do I make up something that's pseudoscientific, sort of like half-truth, which is what you have happening, you know, with all these guys going up on Capitol Hill that we talked about? I said, no. If she asked a question, I'm going to assume she's ready to hear the answer. So I told her what I've just told you, and that it's an interface between the conscious field, thought, and very advanced technologies. And she says, I thought it had to be something like that. I almost fell out of my chair. I was going, oh, my God, she totally got it.
Well, you know, this is something that I've been thinking about for a little while, is the whole concept of the realm of the imagination. What exactly is the realm of the imagination? Mm. You know, human beings, everything that we're using, this microphone, this laptop, everything, the things I'm wearing, it's all come from a non-physical space that we have the ability to access, pull information from and manifest it into this reality, which is a fascinating thing that nothing else is really doing on this planet. And it makes me think that potentially the realm of consciousness, the realm of mind, is a real dimensional space. And these vehicles, this technology, has the ability to traverse that space. As outrageous as that sounds to a lot of people, I think that this shared space between transcendental consciousness, psychedelic experiences, even near-death experiences, and UFOs is a consistent correlation. So I feel like they could be traversing the realm of thought.
No, they are, and there's no question, and including the entire craft. So let's say you're 3D matter, right here. Oops, someone's knocked over this thing. If you're going to then traverse and go interstellar, you're going to resonantly shift out of linear space time into another dimension that closely approximates what the mystics call the astral, and go foomp. In there. And I've known this since 1973, when I died, a near-death experience, and then 6 months later had my first full-on contact experience with ETs. So I've never done any drugs, but that was very clear to me that that's what they were doing. Now, at age 18, I was an 18-year-old guy. I didn't really understand it. But then I started studying the science of consciousness, and the Vedas, and the siddhis, S-I-D-D-H-I-S, these abilities and skills and powers that evolve from, people who practice meditation a great deal. And I realized that, in fact, if you understand consciousness in the siddhis, you understand the interstellar reality. And so a lot of the nuts and bolts people in the UFO community hate that I bring all that stuff in. But I said, otherwise, you're just kicking the tires of a man-made UFO. You're not comprehending the interstellar ones. You're actually locked into a 3D paradigm, dinosaur era stuff, frankly. And by the way, the ones that are man-made, the UFOs that are man-made, they'll have sort of a transformer sound up close, but they also have seams and rivets and sections. Interstellar ones do not, because the way they're manufactured, that's another whole show. But we know how they're manufactured. It isn't digging stuff out of the earth. It's actually the materialization of our craft. Like
forming the resonance
from a template, a detailed template. And it's actually comes into 3D through the interface between this dimension and that energy field some people call zero point. And the sort of accumulation of the subatomic and then atomic and molecular elements. So this is why when you analyze the materiel, we have no correlation for it. This is why everyone's stumped. Mm-hmm. Or a complex device is ET. The device, the circuit, all of it is all of a part. It's all integrated. There's no sections. And this completely blew the mind of the early scientists. I know this. So now we're getting into some really cool stuff. But most people in the UFO world are looking at advanced versions of a Boeing jet that just has a different propulsion system, right? But the stuff that fascinates me is like, that's cool. That was that we mastered gravity control in October of 1954. But I think that's why we have to look at this, but we have to take it stepwise. I mean, you're dealing with people in the scientific world or political world. They're still asking, gee, is that Tic Tac from China? So the honest truth of this is that we have to be compassionate enough to understand that people who are trying to find out about this don't know what you know. They're not at your level. They're at the level of first asking, what is this? But that's why we need to have people come forward who do know. Not just myself. I always tell people I'm a door for all these other top secret guys to come in. Because I have no official status. I've never been in a classified project. Ironically, I know more than most of the people in them because I have, we're silo smashers. You know, a silo is a compartmented operation. And I've sort of smashed hundreds and hundreds of silos and had people in them give me information, documents, what have you. But now what we need to do is find more of those, the ones that are still living, and better yet, ones currently active, who will come in and provide truthful information, not gaslight them, not half-truths, truthful information to the key people in the U.S. government who sincerely are trying for once to find out the truth. So I hope anyone who is that person or knows someone like that can network us together. And they'll be handled very sensitively and confidentially. But we can bring them in. Absolutely. And we are. It's time.
It is time.
75, 80 years on. Let's get on with it, right?
Yeah, it is time. It is time. And I'm excited about the prospect of a potential another national press conference event, because the 2001 press conference event was just a seminal moment. And obviously, anyone who's aware of the event would know that it was quickly overshadowed by the trauma of 9/11, which happened not long afterwards. And I imagine if that hadn't have happened, it may have caused a larger shockwave around the world. You're planning to set up another conference of that kind of magnitude. That's an exciting prospect, because I think something like that in this day and age with the social media that
it's whatever the public supports.
Yeah. Of course.
So of course, everything we've done is crowdfunded. I don't get paid. I don't need it. So everything is crowdfunded. The film's crowdfunded. These events, the first national press event was crowdfunded. Donors. It's up to the public. We can do anything. What do people want to support? And the other part of it is who wants to come forward now? That's, you know, it's another whole wave of these folks. Like your friend in Florida that you met with, he needs to get hold of me.
Oh, I'm sure we could organize that.
Well, make it happen.
Yeah.
So these people, look, it's like no one person. And this is the problem. Here's a big problem we haven't talked about. The nature of compartmentalized information, you know, top secret, special compartmented information. But the compartmentalization means that people may know a great deal about a little teeny area, but they're not going to know. So what I'm trying to do, and I've been working and putting together for 30 years, is a mosaic. The whole, so this piece and that piece, and then do the intelligence analysis. Or how does this relate to this? And that's actually the biggest part of what I'm trying to do for these investigators in the U.S. government. Because it's not enough just to say, here's a data dump. You know, here's all, you know, 8 terabytes of data. What does it mean? And how is this connected to this? We know that now. So that is the hard, that's the heavy lift. That's the very heavy lift. What's behind it? Who's behind it? Why? What's the architecture of the programs? What has been their evolution in history? What's the funding mechanism for them? And it's complex. It's not just governmental. So, you know, all that has to get unpacked and all those dots. But so I always tell people, a lot of people think, oh, I was just involved for this incident or this one period of time, and it's not important. It is important, because that bit of data and information and intelligence then plugs in to the mosaic. And that's how you make the whole picture make any sense. So when I started out, I had my own experiences and sightings and contact, but I had this little teeny few pieces of the mosaic. Now we have thousands of pieces of the mosaic, but there need to be more, because I have no official standing at all. I've done all of this, and even bringing people into DC currently, I'm funding that. We will not let the U.S. government fund it because it gets on the radar. So people need to understand what this task is. It's daunting.
How have you done this for so long and kept your sanity?
Well, you have a big family, you have people you love, you have friends you love. I do a lot of working out, sports and mountain biking and surfing and fun, make things fun. So, you know, you just have to, you know, you have to balance. You have to balance your life, you know.
Yeah,
it's all about balance, you know. So, and luckily I have an angel for a wife, and I have angels for friends. Some of who go back 40, 50 years. I'm 67. I have dear friends I've had since I was 18, 19. So, you know, that helps. You know, that helps.
Well, Dr. Greer, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for taking this time to have a conversation.
Yeah.
It's been interesting. I feel like we've covered some good ground. We've had a few back and forths on some of the deeper aspects of this, and you've told us that there are things coming in the pipeline. So 2023 could be an important year.
Yeah, and let everyone help us. Go to thelostcenturyfilm.com.
Links will be in the description box.
I think we're about two-thirds of the way to our goal for funding this production and getting it out in May. So we're going to be making good progress.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.